Hi there, I'm Barbara Newman, the editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Welcome to Speculum Spotlight, our quarterly podcast in collaboration with the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Each episode normally brings you behind the scenes of an article in our current issue, but this month's program deals with Speculations, our landmark centennial issue, which features more than 50 short articles imagining the possible futures of medieval studies. The hosts and producers of this episode are Jonathan Correa Reyes, Will Beatty, and Lauren Cantrell. They interview the five editors of the centennial issue, Mohammed Ballin, Cecily J. Hillsdale, Catherine L. Jansen, Sierra Lamuto, and Peggy McCracken. You can find short bios for each of the participants in the episode description.
Today we're speaking with the editors of Speculations, Speculum's centennial issue, and a call for introspection, for reckoning with the future, and for speculation. We managed to pin down all five editors, a feat itself, given their busy schedules, and they are Mohammed Ballin, Cecily J. Hillsdale, Catherine L. Jansen, Sierra Lamuto, and Peggy McCracken. Thank you all very much for joining us today. We want to begin this episode by congratulating you all on steering this enormous endeavor. Academic journal publication is a complex thing at the best of times, but with Speculations, you have opened the Speculum Journal up to over 50 essays by medievalists from across the world, scholars of an incredible range of periods, places, cultures, characters, and texts. And the topics they address here are even more varied. Today, we'd like to explore the special issue a little further, the inspiration behind it, the process, and how it might impact the field into the future. A through line for your editor's introduction is a meditation on the ways in which we mark time. Your point of departure for this reflection is the beautiful image included in a 15th century French translation of Henri Suso's Orologium Sapientiae, in which Sapientia, or wisdom, represented as a woman, appears to be teaching a Dominican disciple, probably Henri Suso himself, about one of the various mechanical clocks that fill the room. Why did you choose this meditation on the marking of time to open this centennial issue, which, as the name Speculation suggests, aims to ruminate on the possible futures of medieval studies?
I think I'll take that question as the art historian on the committee. I'm really glad that you brought this up as a key question. The image foregrounds so many of our central investments in this whole process. So even though we found the image really in the 11th hour, and I think that credit goes entirely to Mohammed, if I recall, who first suggested we look at this book. So we found it quite late, but it actually encapsulates a lot of the ideas that went back to the very beginning of our conversations about this endeavor. And I can remember those conversations like they were yesterday, even though they were many years ago by now. So in some sense, the image is so palpably and literally about time and its marking. There's something very literal and appropriate about it. It's totally in keeping with what an anniversary is about, taking stock, celebrating a history, marking time. But it does so much more than that. This image really does amazing work for our volume, for our introduction, for our thinking. And when we first explored the idea of a centennial volume, one of the early ideas we had was actually to think about a theme around temporality and the temporal structures that organize the field and its historiography. And this gave way, I think, in the end to something related but much more capacious, the idea of speculations. But to have come to this image at the end, really, as we were reflecting on the volume itself and the years we'd put into it, felt really felicitous. It felt very right. It felt like once we had this image, the intro kind of flowed and came into place in a nice way. It's an image about marking time, but the plethora of instruments that fill this kind of clock chamber represent our investments in, I think, at least three ways. The first is that it's a dialogue. As you pointed out, this gorgeously powerful female personification of wisdom really fills the frame of the cover. But she's teaching. Her book is open, the page is turning. And so it's really a scene of the unfolding of wisdom and the process of learning. So that seems really appropriate to as a kind of mirror for our field. As medieval studies right now, we have a lot to learn. we have learned a lot, and it is very much appropriate in that sense, this kind of dialogic nature of it. The second issue that I think I really like about the image has to do with technology and cross-cultural engagement. This was something that was really key in some of our early conversations as well. So the instruments themselves, which like fill the frame, represent different technologies that are located in sites nearly global in scope. So there is a kind of geographic vastness to the technologies that these different instruments represent. So knowledge and instrumentation really is pictured here on the cover as a cross-cultural investment. So the clock chamber is full of time, but also about space and engagement over time. And that was something that was very important to our early conversations as well. A third dimension of the image is sonic and also imperative. When I look at the page of instruments, I can hear the gears turning and squeaking, the cogs moving. There's something very loud about the image. And of course, at the top of the folio is the bell that's about to be set off by wisdom. So it's an alarm clock, essentially. And that's a really powerful image of time, that it's not just time passing and time marking, but time that's meant to rouse you. For me, this is the key part of this image that speaks to our investment, that marking time isn't just about navel gazing and celebration, but taking stock and thinking about where we are, where we've been, but where we need to go. So it's really a powerful future-oriented image. And that, I think, it really conceptually got us from marking time to a more speculative, forward-oriented conversation about the field.
I'm always in awe of art historians and how they talk about art and images, because it's not something I'm particularly literate in, and I just want to listen to you keep going on and on and on.
Give me an image and a keyboard and I'm in my happy place.
I feel that way with literature. I just need one example and I can write an entire essay about it. That's all I need. As we move along, I think that as impressive as the image is, I am also in awe of the introduction and the kind of vision that it charts for medieval studies. And there is one sentence that I feel beautifully captures your vision for the future of our field. You write, "The issue is thus born from a collective understanding that the future of medieval studies, or indeed any project of intellectual engagement, depends on unimagined potentialities and must act as a haven for the risks they necessitate," end quote. This sentence resonated with me because it acknowledges two important things. First, it captures the need for innovation in medieval studies to consider archives and voices that have been long neglected in our field of study. And when I say voices, I am not only referring to the documents and objects we commune with as part of our research, but I also refer to the valuable contributions of scholars who have not always felt welcome. Second, this sentence clearly articulates a shared responsibility for medievalists to create and sustain a sanctuary for the scholars who are taking these risks as they pursue their research agendas. These risks can be conceptually exciting, but they can also present serious material consequences as well, especially at a time when academic freedom is under siege. I want to hear you talk more about this vision for the field of medieval studies as a haven. Mohammed and Sierra, maybe we can get started with you too.
Yes, thank you so much, John, for this question. So this is, I think, the point that is at the heart of this volume for me, and I know for this entire editorial collective as well, which is really that as scholars, we do need to take risks, and also we need to support risk-taking. Medieval studies, and I think actually it's not just medieval studies, it's academia in general, but medieval studies is the field that we're all part of, is not the most welcome space for marginalized people. And why is that? Sometimes there are certainly overt and deliberate hostilities, but more often, particularly I think in medieval studies and also in our current climate, it more comes from a beneath the surface fear of change, of being confronted with the problems that perhaps you didn't even realize were problems. But because when people from different backgrounds and experiences come in, they're able to actually see some of these problems in ways that would not have otherwise been seen. And this can, I think, feel threatening at first. When people feel threatened, they enact defense mechanisms that can actually double down on all of those problems, whether intentional or not. But in fact, these new perspectives are not threatening, right? They are actually transformative, and transformative in ways that are often beautifully productive and, as we know, necessary for intellectual advancement. And in this case, for, I think, the continuing relevance for studying an incredibly remote and distant past in this moment. So in putting together this volume, all of the editors really really wanted to take this point seriously. We wanted to remain committed to publishing and platforming new ways of thinking about the medieval past that in many cases takes us out of the field's comfort zone. In many cases, this means honoring actually the way that scholars' identities and personal experiences inform their scholarship. And for me, in my experience, this is actually one of the riskiest positions to take as a scholar, to say that my identity and my personal experiences do not actually need to be sidelined in order to be taken seriously as a scholar, but actually that my identity and my experiences are my superpowers that bring even more rigor to my scholarship. That's really what we wanted to honor as this editorial collective in these articles. So at the same time that we want scholars to take risks and we want these new perspectives to transform the field, we also need the scholars with more power in the field to embrace that risk-taking and say, we will support you and we really value what you have to say.
Yeah, I fully agree with everything Sierra was saying, if I may just follow up a little bit. And I think what we did was we were able to put together an amazing volume, which keeps the rigor, it keeps the focus on the disciplines while also being truly interdisciplinary and also pushing the boundaries of the field and of inquiry and looking at notions like positionality, right? I think with each of our editorial kind of positions, this is what we did. We pushed our authors a little bit to kind of think outside the box and to take risks. You'd be surprised how hesitant some people were to actually take those risks and to speculate. It's important to think about how this volume allowed some of our authors, because of its unique format, to actually break those boundaries because we asked them to. And maybe this is an experiment that can be taken forward in other ways as well. But I do want to echo what Sierra said. I think it's really important for us as a field to reflect upon where we're sort of going right and wrong. And at least with this editorial board, I was very happy that we were able to always talk about everything. And this is actually kind of a dream team. It doesn't replicate itself easily. I was very excited to be part of this for this reason. I mean, given that I come from Islamic studies, which is already a kind of a marginal field of a marginal field in some respects. So I thought it was really exciting to be able to kind of participate in these discussions. It allowed me to think about, what do I have to contribute to medieval studies?
I am very much excited for the kind of impact that this issue is going to have. And turning to the issue itself, for our next question, we wanted to talk a bit about the title, Speculations. To speculate means to form a theory or conjecture without firm evidence. In other words, to speculate is to make a guess. I will confess that as an avid reader of science fiction and fantasy, I love this verb. After reading your introduction and hearing from some of you, this term is clearly vital for your vision of the future of medieval studies. So my question, how are you thinking about the work of speculation in the context of this centennial issue? And what impact do you hope this issue will have on medievalists as we hopefully open the next 100-year-long chapter of Speculum? Kate, as the former editor of Speculum, and Peggy, as the current president of the Medieval Academy of America, I would love to hear from the two of you.
Hi, everybody. It's Kate here. I'd like to commend Cecily for her beautiful explication of speculations in her introduction to the image. So the title Speculations came out of those first ad hoc committee meetings, and it was meant to be a meditation on time and one which perhaps indicates that time resists disaggregation. I think we were called on not just to reflect on the past, but to reflect on the present and how both the past and the present might just inform the future. And so with that in mind, the word calls for experimentation. Riffs, I think, is a word that we used in the introduction, a plurality of voices and approaches, and even reflections on the counterfactual, posing the question of what if the roads not taken in the past, and where would they have led us if we had taken some of those roads? I would say that, as we've already suggested, there are many ways to commemorate the passage of time and the marking of an anniversary, and looking back and taking stock is one of them. But we also wanted to speculate on what the future might hold, informed as we are by the past and the present. Many of our essays are making best guesses about the future of medieval studies, and many of them have specific proposals on how we might get there, which I think is of great interest in the issue. Some advocate for more collaboration with the hard sciences. A few make the case of how we can be more comparative and more global in our approach. Many take up the mantle of adopting digital methodologies. And a number discuss how theory can help us to envision the future. So if nothing else, I think that this issue is very much a representative snapshot of where we are now in medieval studies. And of course, our hope is that it will ignite conversations among our many colleagues. But if we make it to 2116, I think it will be an informative time capsule of where we are in 2026, just as that first issue of Speculum of 1926 is very much an informative time capsule of where the just being born discipline was in that period. Peggy, I hand it over to you.
I would just add to what Kate said that, John, I really like the way you cited what speculation is, to form a theory or conjecture without firm evidence. We wanted to tweak that a little bit and have people use evidence to speculate in order to think about new ways of reading evidence, kind of similar to what Sierra was saying earlier. And we didn't know what we would get. And we didn't know if we would get anything. We were a little worried about, you know, are people going to respond? Is this going to appeal to people? And then in the end, we got more than 200 submissions. And not only did we get submissions, but people would send their abstracts with little notes that said, oh, I'm so excited about this issue. Or, you know, this is really a great way to think about medieval studies. I mean, people were really enthusiastic about the format, which we intentionally kept the essays quite short. We thought that might be a mode or a form in which people would feel free to speculate a little more. I'm not sure we thought about this explicitly, but it seems like one of the things that speculations does is kind of give people permission to speculate. And we can hope that might be even a methodology that people will continue to use to think about the evidence they work with, the theories they use to think about their evidence, the methodologies they use to explore the Middle Ages. So we're hopeful that we made a difference in that respect as well.
It's really fascinating to hear about the wide range, the plurality of voices that you're incorporating in this special issue. You mentioned that you received over 200 proposals and accepted a total of about 60 essays, which is an impressive and very generous editorial undertaking. Considering that in the introduction, you productively and provocatively describe medieval studies as a field, quote, in the midst of necessary change and adaptation, I want to invite you to speak about your selection process. What about these 60 or so essays made you excited about the future of medieval studies?
Well, I could start. Others may correct me or have better things to say than I do, but I think we brought a variety of selection criteria to thinking about the essays. They're quite different from each other. There wasn't a really one-size-fits-all evaluation process we could use. We accepted proposals, not full essays. So we got some surprises along the way. People changed or they did something a little different from what we thought they were going to do. And we strived for some notion of coverage, which we did not succeed in having essays about every aspect of medieval studies. There's some significant gaps. That was a function of selections, a function of submissions. We tried to have a representative selection of people in terms of rank and career stage. Mostly we went with people who were saying something we thought was exciting and sometimes quite unexpected about the Middle Ages. I mean, others would have more to add to that, I think.
I'll jump in just with one point, Peggy. You know, the question about selection process is interesting because the end product was really wholly dependent on what was turned in, what was submitted originally. And I think it speaks to this chance element of speculation itself. I think we all had a vision of what we would get, and we didn't necessarily get that vision. We got something quite different. And so I found the process to be delightfully surprising, I would say, in what we received and the decisions we could make and couldn't make. And what I really liked was actually the conversations that as a group we had about what it meant to have such a diverse group of essays that didn't give us coverage. And some fields overrepresented, some entirely absent. And it was really heuristically instructive, puzzling, and in the end, there's something kind of serendipitous about the final roster, I think. Sierra, did you have anything you wanted to?
Yeah, I did want to jump in because the selection process in my memory was really one of the most delightful parts of this whole process. It could have felt really overwhelming, and it was. But I think what worked so well in that process was the conversations that the five of us had. And for me, it was really seeing how the kind of plurality that we wanted represented in the volume was actually modeled in the selection process itself, that we all didn't come together and have the same ideas about which abstracts should make it in. But we devised a system where we could equally share our perspectives on it. Even when we disagreed, we could still talk about it and come to some kind of, in some cases, not consensus, because in some cases, we just ended up trusting other people's perspectives and saying, okay, I don't necessarily see the speculation in this abstract, but somebody else did see it. And it ended up working out really well. And I think that speaks to the ethos of the volume, that we're trusting in other people's perspectives that I might not have, and that that will lead to a really productive, important article that is advancing the field. So it was a really rewarding selection process, as overwhelming as it was.
Yeah, I think it was the best part, actually, the selection process. I really enjoyed it. And I disagree with Sierra on one thing. The best part of the process was how she made it so easy for all of us because of her incredible organizational skills and spreadsheets and all the rest. So that's the only thing I disagree with Sierra on. But I do want to say, yes, having the opportunity to have these interdisciplinary conversations among ourselves was the best part for me, by far. I don't know if I'll ever have this opportunity again to speak to such eminent sort of scholars about every single part of the field. So it was actually one of the most exciting aspects. So for example, as a historian, how do you explain why this is an interesting trend or not an interesting trend to somebody who's not a historian? Same thing with Sierra. I'm sure we drove you crazy, the historians anyways. Peggy and Cecily as well. I remember our conversations in Cambridge about sort of specific essays and why they are pushing boundaries and why they're not traditional, for example. So I thought that was one of the best parts for me. And actually that really allowed us as scholars, I think about our own work in new ways.
Thank you, Muhammad. I just wanted to jump in and say that was also a really beautiful experience, being able to use my love of Excel and love of spreadsheets.
No collaborative projects that don't include Sierra for me ever again.
And I would just like to add to this collection of voices that for me, it was just so gratifying because as editor of Speculum for 5 years, I was mainly doing the selection process by myself, of course, with the help of our peer reviewers. But here in Speculations, we had this wonderful opportunity to discuss and to learn from each other.
I just want to take this opportunity to acknowledge and thank you, Kate, for your stewardship of Speculum. I don't think that this centennial issue, as it exists, would have been possible if not for your vision. I remember as a graduate student thinking about Speculum as an unbreachable publication platform, but you've really made it a point of opening up the journal to the diverse cacophony of voices that the field needs if it is to effect lasting change for the future, as Sierra was saying. So, if we make it through the next 100 years, it will be in no small part thanks to your work and vision. I just want that to be on the record of this time capsule as well.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate that. And just know that everything I did at Speculum was with you all in mind, with the rising cohort of scholars. Thank you.
Well, that in mind, I just really enjoyed hearing you all talk about what a great opportunity this was to have a conversation across disciplines and across careers. And I did want to selfishly highlight that Will and I were part of the Graduate Student Committee's submission to the volume. And that was such a great opportunity for us, I felt like, to have our own conversation among graduate students who are now, over the course of this editing process, entering our careers. So I guess I just wanted to bring that up and have Will comment on it as well. What was your experience like writing this piece? I mean, I know for me that it was a challenge in that as graduate students, we're not normally encouraged or trained or even given the opportunity to do a multi-author piece like that. We had 5 people working on this together. And so that was a challenge, but it was a really unique opportunity, I felt like, for us to kind of take the temperature as graduate students.
I would agree. I think it was a wonderful opportunity. And yes, we don't often have those opportunities in the humanities to do that kind of collaborative thinking. And so it did present really interesting challenges. But as I suppose broadly the main coordinator, it was a lot of fun trying to think through how we would come up with an abstract which we felt was relevant and would reflect our different interests and concerns with the future of medieval studies. And then just going through that process, I think it showed me how much opportunity there is there for more collaborative approaches in the humanities broadly. And I think the speculations is a great example of that. And I hope that this is something we'll see modeled more and more in the humanities and medieval studies more specifically.
Yeah, we pushed it, I think. And we should definitely say that us submitting an abstract at all was spearheaded by a fellow committee member, Masha Golden. So if it weren't for her, we wouldn't have even attempted it. And I'm really glad that we did.
Absolutely, yeah. Masha was a huge part of this. Wouldn't have happened without her.
So we're entering the tail end of our conversation, and we wanted to make sure that we were acknowledging both the origins of the journal and the future of the journal, since this is such a mile marker with the centennial year. And this is a bit on the funnier side, but I really loved how in the introduction you acknowledged the awkwardness of the title of the journal, which for many of us brings to mind certain things. And I'd love to hear you guys talk a bit more about that and how the very title of the journal brings about some sense of its origins and the people who are originating this journal, but then how now we have new voices entering into the journal. So I suppose if I could open it up to everyone to talk both about the origins of the journal and what that means to us in the present moment, and then also looking forward to the next centennial, what could we expect in the next 100 years of Speculum?
Thinking about the origins of the journal was a massive part of the conversation. In fact, Kate did a lot of research on this, and I'm happy to say we were the first to hear what she had to say on this, because she spoke to the Medieval Academy about it as a whole. And it really helped us reflect as to where we are and where we're going as a field. So we wanted to capture that same rigor and philology and all the rest that the founders of the journal had intended. But we also wanted to think carefully and critically about where we are now in comparison. So that was one really motivating factor in how we wrote the introduction. And I think going back, and Kate maybe can speak more to this, the process of going back and looking at the founding documents, so to speak, of Speculum and the Medieval Academy, I think was very formative in that process.
So yes, the title of Speculum, always a problem, I think, for women. And I think it was instructive to have a section on the choosing of the title, especially for a new generation of scholars. I remember in the Studying Medieval Women issue of 1993, and that was among the very first themed issues of the journal. I remember very well Judith Bennett's article, which was called Medievalism and Feminism. And in its first few pages, she talks about the choosing of the title Speculum, and she is very unsympathetic toward the founders and the reasons for choosing it. But what we found when we went back to the documents was, yes, E.K. Rand sort of thought of the title. In fact, he woke up in the middle of the night with an epiphany that the journal should be called Speculum. And evidently, he was the prime mover and shaker of that title, because there were a number of other titles that were proposed for the journal. And reading over the minutes of all of the meetings that led up to the founding of the journal, it took 10 months for the decision to finally be made that the journal would be called Speculum. And I think that speaks to the fact that there was probably dissension among the ranks, that that title gave pause to a number of people, as it still does now. Certainly in my own case, as a young medievalist, I thought, why is this journal called Speculum? And that awkwardness has remained with me even through my 6 years as editor of the journal. Whenever I have to speak to people who are not medievalists, I have to remember to say, Speculum means mirror in Latin, because otherwise you're greeted by raised eyebrows and looks of shock and dismay about why this journal is called Speculum. So I think that probably every generation needs a reminder of how the journal came to be entitled Speculum, and that it wasn't universally accepted amongst the founders.
Kate, if I could just weigh in, you know, we've all had the experience where we're speaking with people who are not medievalists. I mean, that's what we should be doing, talking to people outside of our field. I think the more that we can assure people that medieval studies is not a silo that's impenetrable, the better our field will be. And I think the word speculum, what you just said, is exactly that example. Every time I'm with people and I mention speculum, I always get that look. How could you not get that look? I have to explain it or say it's a long story or, you know, somehow defer and push it to the side, the fact that the central journal of our field is called Speculum. And so in our conversations in editing speculations, we weren't dogmatic about things, but I do have to say, to come back to the cover image, the idea of foregrounding a female body visually on the centennial volume of Speculum, I think is a really powerful metaphor for the kinds of work that we want this volume to do, which is both questioning a history, but also thinking about where we are now, how we've changed, and hopefully that being model in place for the future, some kind of template or thought process for thinking about the future.
One of the things that has always stayed with me since I first started graduate school was something a friend of mine said from undergrad, which was that it is me or our scholars who are in the field who create the field. And what he was saying to me was, I get to actually carve my own space in the field. Granted, we do need the more senior scholars to create a haven for that. But that has always stayed with me, this idea that the field that you want to see or you envision, you have a role in creating that. And so when I think about 100 years in the future, what is medieval studies going to be? Or is it even going to exist as such? We might have a different disciplinary formation that studies the same past. As long as we are committed to these studies, it can look however we want it to look. I think that's the most exciting thing.
Well, thank you all for being here with us today. This has been an incredibly stimulating conversation, and I think I speak for all three of us and the rest of our team when I say that we're very much excited for the publication of this centennial issue. Are there any last comments, thoughts, burning emotions that you want to get out of your chest?
I just wanted to thank you again for these great questions. I think all five of us, I don't mean to speak for us, but we had so much fun working together. And I think you're probably getting a sense of that from our conversation. We have a way of being together, mostly on Zoom, that has been just amazing. I think transformative, certainly for each in our own ways. And so to have you all come up with these amazing questions that really took seriously our work felt really validating.
Thank you, Cecily, and thank you all again. Maybe the next issue of Speculum can be on Sierra spreadsheets.
Many thanks to John, Will, and Lauren, and to Muhammad, Cecily, Kate, Sierra, and Peggy for this fascinating conversation. You can already read Speculum's centennial issue, Speculations, online. Let me also thank the Multicultural Middle Ages team, Will Beattie, Lauren Cantrell, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and Jonathan Correa Reyes. In addition, I want to thank the Speculum editorial staff, Ben Weil and Lily Stewart, and the Medieval Academy itself for co-sponsoring this podcast. Music for the MMA is by Anna O'Connell. I'm Barbara Newman, editor of Speculum, the Journal of the Medieval Academy of America, published by the University of Chicago Press. If you join the Medieval Academy, you'll receive a subscription to both print and digital editions. Online, you can find us at journals.uchicago.edu. We'll be back in April with the next episode of Speculum Spotlight.